Listen to a different translation of the text than we just heard. With the parables, it's good to hear a number of translations. And this one is from Amy Jill Levine, and you'll hear more about her later. She says, if it sounds weird, so much the better. Similar to the kingdom of heaven is leaven that a woman taking hid in 3 measures of flour until was leavened all. How many of you have ever made bread? Lots of you. Some of you know that I do not especially love the kitchen. I do bake oatmeal bread, but when I started reading for this sermon, the first thing I learned was that when Jesus says leaven, he does not mean the little dry instant granules of yeast that I keep in my refrigerator door. The kingdom of heaven Jesus was talking about is more like the sourdough starter that my friend Natasha, who has long been a real baker, keeps in her fridge. So I asked her for some, and she gave me about 2 cups of a starter that she has kept alive for almost 15 years. How many of you have ever made sourdough bread using starter? How many of you have one that you've kept alive a really long time? So what's it like? Color, texture, smell? Those of you who've used it, just shout it out. Spongy. Sour, fruity smell. Yeah, the recipe books call it a pleasant sour smell. So grayish white, stretchy smooth, the pleasant sour smell. Nothing I would want to eat as is. And my instructions told me to add 1.5 cups of water and, quote, enough flour to make a sticky ball. Cover. Let rest at room temperature for approximately 12 hours. And you do this flour, water, and 12-hour wait twice before you finally add more water, some salt, quote, enough flour to make a firm bread dough. Let it rise and bake. I don't want to tell you how many times in the last 2 weeks I thought, ooh, I can bake bread, and then counted 12 hours. Nope, that would have me adding flour and water at 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't make kingdom of heaven today. As Carrie Newcomer sings, you can't rush the earth or heaven, or the time it takes for bread to leaven. Some things just take a little while. Some things just have to take their own time. So now we're going to let the sourdough part of this sermon rest at room temperature while we think about something else for a little while. Because that is what leavening sourdough and writing a sermon and maybe nurturing the kingdom too is like. You maybe weren't counting on a sermon of 12 hours at room temperature times 2, were you? Today we begin 6 weeks on the short stories of Jesus as the writer of the Gospel of Luke recorded them. As a worship committee, we worked with a book by Jewish biblical scholar Amy Jill Levine. She is interested in how first century Jews might have heard the parables. They lived in a Jewish world like Jesus and didn't already know the Jesus story, the gospel perspectives on his ministry, his death and resurrection, the story of the early church, as we do. Levine insists on the value of hearing these stories not as Christian allegories with various characters representing God or Jesus or the church and meaning collectively something like, Jesus wants you to be nice. Jesus was nice and wants you to be nice too. But as disturbing stories meant to, quote, afflict the comfortable. Many of them are also humorous, especially in their original context. But even there, more often than not, it's an uncomfortable laughter, or at least laughter along with much to ponder. Christian interpretations of this particular parable have often made much of leaven being, quote, unclean, and representing Gentiles or others considered corrupt or sinners according to Jewish purity laws. Mixing them into the dough represents their inclusion in the kingdom of heaven. Levine urges us to clear our palates of that interpretation. In the first place, she says, leaven is not religiously unclean. if it were, Jews would not have had to remove it from their homes at Passover, then or now, because they would not have used it in the first place. She insists, and I decided to quote her a little at length here because this understanding of Jewish purity codes may be relevant to our study of parables as a whole. There's no historical basis for the claim that Judaism made outcasts of people who did not observe purity laws, or the related claim that the purity laws themselves were an impossible burden on the poor. Archaeological evidence shows that Jesus and his followers observed the purity laws. Attending to the birth of a child or the burial of a corpse should not be followed immediately by a return to the world of business as usual, but should require taking the time to recognize the power of life and death. For those early Jews, the practices not only manifested their participation in the covenant, they also affirmed their identity as Jews within the wider Roman Empire. We might think of purity concerns as an ancient form of what we today call identity formation. Besides Levine, I had two other guides as I worked. One was our own resident scholar, Luke scholar, Mary Schertz, who taught the Luke Acts class I took in seminary. She will not be preaching on the parables during this series, but she will explain all things to us in private during second hour, beginning next Sunday. My third companion guide is an Episcopal priest, teacher, and retreat leader named Cynthia Bourgeau. This fall, I am part of a group at Pathways Retreat, reading together her book entitled The Wisdom Jesus. And it feels a little risky to offer you a taste of these ideas that I am still learning, but they so enlivened this parable for me. Bourgeau sees Jesus as a wisdom teacher, meaning he taught out of a specific ancient stream present in many spiritual traditions, the same stream as the authors of Hebrew wisdom literature, such as the book of Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, and some of the Psalms. Parables are a wisdom genre, a hallmark of wisdom teaching. Bourgeau says Jesus was a master of wisdom, pushing the Proverbs, for example, far beyond conventional wisdom. Quote, a proverb is something along the lines of Aesop's fables, a teaching story with a moral to it, whose purpose is to help us live better and wiser lives. Jesus' parables are much closer to what in Zen tradition would be koans, profound paradoxes or riddles, if you like, that are intended to push us into new ways of seeing. Bourgeau says this new seeing Jesus was inviting is what might be called today non-dual consciousness or unitive seeing, an awareness that sees no separation between God and humans or humans and other humans. Jesus' most beautiful description of this is the teaching in John 15, where he says, I am the vine, you are the branches. Abide in me as I in you. This way of seeing the world, says Bourgeau, is what Jesus means by the phrase kingdom of heaven, which he uses so often. Many of the parables, like this parable of the leaven, begin, the kingdom of heaven is like. For Jesus, the kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of heaven, as some prefer, is not primarily a place you go after you die, or even a utopian political or social reality. It is Jesus' favorite metaphor for the way the world looks through the eyes of non-dual consciousness. I've had glimpses of non-dual consciousness. So have you. Maybe it was looking out over the valley after you struggled up the last stretch of that arduous hike, or watching the moon rise over Tucson from high in Saguaro National Park. Maybe it was once riding the city bus when suddenly looking around, it seemed like everyone was your relative. Maybe it was yesterday, bathing your child, speaking with a patient or a student, and you suddenly saw her, became aware of her presence and the connection between you. Maybe there have even been times when you felt at once so open and light, so radically present and available, you might float away, and at the same time, deeply connected. I'm convinced that very young children experience life this way much of the time and grow out of it. Jesus, who said we have to be like little children to enter the kingdom of heaven, grew back into it or never left it, and seems to be saying it is possible to live from this connected way of seeing and being more of the time. It's not about seeking mystical experiences of spiritual bliss, but rather integrating this awareness of connection into ongoing daily life. And the people who've done this integrating deeply tend to come across as very unassuming, but there's much going on under the surface and the healing and the life giving expands around them. I was thinking this morning of Mr. Rogers. Time to go back to the kitchen. Next to my kitchen sink, I keep a quote from St. Teresa of Avila that is a kind of koan. This formidable saint, best known for her writing on mystical prayer, says, "God is among the saucepans." I have been turning these particular words of St. Teresa's around and around for at least 5 years of dishes. Sometimes I think I catch glimpses of what they mean. I keep those words by my kitchen sink not because I experience God there, but because I need to be reminded to consider that possibility when the dishes have again piled up and God among the saucepans does not smell very nice. Sourdough leaven, too, is ordinary and very local, affected by weather and temperature, and doesn't always smell nice, in the process at least. It happens when the local airborne varieties of wild yeast spores, which are present just about everywhere on Earth, take up residence in the flour and water you or I have put out for them and begin to make carbohydrates into carbon dioxide. Might this parable of the woman making sourdough remind us to reevaluate or revalue the most ordinary elements of our daily lives in the very personal, even domestic sphere, as in Jesus' story, or in our lives together at the communal oven, as it were? As Levine puts it, what we see as negative or simply utilitarian may have spiritual potential. What we see as negative or simply utilitarian may have spiritual potential. Then there's the fact that yeast is a fungus, and starters work through the process of decay. The kingdom of heaven is like a SCOBY, or symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast, that a woman took and hid in a 25-gallon vat of oolong tea in her dark, cool closet for about 5 weeks until the whole batch was gloriously putrefied and the SCOBY mother had borne a giant baby SCOBY. Now then, at the resurrection, what will she do with all that kombucha? Tea. I will not ask you to raise your hand and admit that you harbor one of these slimy monsters in your closet, Rachel Hustler. But I have to say, speaking of fungi, there's some Holy Spirit. Laura preached a wonderful sermon earlier this fall about the Holy Spirit as fungi that you should hear if you haven't. But back to bread. Bread rises and then stays that way because the yeast does its work, decays, and then dies in the heat of baking, leaving pockets of air. One might ask, unless a yeastie hides in the dough and dies, where is its life? This death in life, life in death theme is everywhere in Luke, says Mary Schurz. Bourgeau says it is a classic, it is classic wisdom teaching, a classic practice of letting go that Jesus modeled constantly. We know it as kenosis in the Christian contemplative tradition. The wisdom tradition asks, according to Bourgeau, what does it mean to die before you die? How do you go about losing your little life to find the bigger one? Is it possible to live on this planet with a generosity, abundance, fearlessness, and beauty that mirror divine being itself? These are wisdom questions, and they are the entire field of Jesus' concern. End quote. And finally, bread. Lots of it. I called Natasha's house. She wasn't even there, but I had to tell them, it's edible. It rose, mostly, I think. I'm glad I didn't make more than these 4 big loaves that are so flat they could almost be mistaken for fishes. But it's good. I'm certainly glad I didn't try using 3 measures of flour. Oh, because 3 measures of flour is not, as I, and maybe you have always assumed, about 3 cups. It's more like 40 to 60 pounds, enough for about 60 dozen biscuits. Dough gets very heavy, and the amount of flour this woman is leavening is far more dough than anyone can knead by herself, far more fresh bread than one family can eat. 3 measures of flour is ridiculous funny. It's foolish extravagance, radical sharing, and or preparation for a really big party. Abundance. In her commentary on Luke, Mary Schertz says, "This Jesus of Luke's gospel cares less about getting anything right than about proximity and generosity." Proximity and generosity. Jesus likes to eat, especially with other people. In fact, Jesus likes to party. He might even be a teensy bit Catholic. I wonder if this parable, if we turn it over and over, might leaven and lighten and sweeten a certain heavy, sour perfectionism that can plague those of us who like to think we take Jesus' vision seriously, who believe he actually meant the Sermon on the Mount and these high, high parable teachings. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but what if it is too much and we can't do it all at once or all by ourselves? What if maybe, just maybe, when we let go, and look again, it turns out that we aren't all by ourselves, and we don't have to, and abundance is all around us. Whenever and wherever we can see that, we're getting closer to the party, the one with more fresh bread than 5,000 can eat, the one with the best wine saved for last, the party where all those who can't possibly measure up and all those too sick or weary to imagine trying are invited.